everybody. Welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. We're heard all around the world on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca, and you can also find us on the Facebook and the Twitter. My name's Janine Bancroft. I'm broadcasting not live from Lekwungen territory today, but I am still in the Coast Salish zone. Sending this file from a beautiful island where I'm looking after a lovely, energetic doggy and his kitty cat friend. But in the program today, for the next hour, I have a couple of pre-recorded segments. The second half is going to be Chrissy Brett, who I met at a rally a couple of weeks ago with a group called Indigenous and Settler Allies. And these folks are concerned about the numbers of children, and particularly Native children, in custody. So there seems to be money that goes into creating foster situations for children, where children are taken from places of concern. Usually the concern is around housing, it seems, from what I can gather. And, of course, that is a concern. You know, we all need housing. So some people are suggesting, you know, rather than remove the child from a situation like that, let's support the parents. Let's create the housing that is affordable. Let's provide some community support. And so what Chrissy talks about is working with Native populations and the settler allies to encourage that. In the first half, Zoe Blunt has recently returned from the Unist'ot'en camp up north. The Social Coast bus went with a bunch of stuff, it sounds like. More stuff was donated than they could bring. She put out a call out at the last minute for cars to caravan up north. And so she talks a little bit about the camp and what's going on there. And really, this is a direct action camp that's stopping the pipelines. The pipelines are a year behind schedule, which is good news. That means that whatever is going on is working. So, you know, for those of us who are concerned about BC's beautiful wilderness and the wild spaces, keeping them wild, you know, not turning them into parks even, but and honoring the Indigenous people who lived here and who are victims of increasingly horrible stories of torture and genocidal attempts. You know, this is where it's happening, and there's not a lot of media around it. So anyways, I talked to Zoe about their journey and the camp. So I hope you stay tuned and enjoy the show.
We did the caravan to Wet'suwet'en. This is the Unist'ot'en camp, and it's up north of Smithers, in the Smithers area, north of Prince George in northern BC. And what these people are doing, these are Indigenous people, Wet'suwet'en, Unist'ot'en clan, and they are blocking the pipeline route. You may know there's not only Enbridge, but several other pipelines that are planned to go across the mountains and terminate in Kitimat on the BC coast. And there's only a certain number of routes that they could take because it's so mountainous and rugged. There's so many big rivers and so on to cross. And so it happens that all these pipeline routes, the Enbridge pipeline, the fracking pipeline, some other tar sands pipelines, they all converge in this one particular area that happens to be Indigenous territory, unceded. It has been continuously occupied for thousands of years. And those people have said, no way are we going to let people put a pipeline through here. No way. It's not happening.
Is it kind of unanimous within that particular community? Because I know in some communities there's divisions about these issues.
Within that clan, it seems to be unanimous. The Wet'suwet'en community is divided. The community of Houston, well, you know, all of BC is really divided on the question of pipelines and whether or not they're safe. And they've got a coalition of the willing. The coalition is growing all the time.
Cool.
And it's funny because the coalition against Enbridge, against the tar sands pipelines, is really really, there's unanimity there with First Nations, with many, many First Nations, and they've spoken about this unbroken wall of opposition that they're creating. At the same time, we have these fracking pipelines, and these are pipelines that are supposed to carry liquefied natural gas from hydraulic fracturing. And so what they're doing is they're doing hydraulic fracturing up in northeastern BC. They're driving huge amounts of fresh water underground under pressure mixed with chemicals, and then it's fracturing the rock layers and causing the natural gas to come out. And this is very destructive to groundwater, very destructive to, it causes earthquakes. There's a lot of evidence now that earthquakes are happening in places that's never had earthquakes before because of this hydraulic fracturing. So this fracking, they're bringing the liquefied natural gas from northeastern BC, from the fracking fields, the shale gas fields, all the way to Kitimat, where they plan to build an LNG plant. And the reason it's going to Kitimat is it's all for export. All of this is for export. None of it is for BC or for Canada.
How much fracking is currently going on? Because I've seen, you know, Gasland and the second Gasland, and I know even Matt Damon has made a film about fracking, and David Letterman's talking about fracking. I mean, it's a big issue right now.
There's more and more of it happening all the time. Oh. You know, it's new. Like, they've only just started doing this in the last, you know, in a large commercial scale in the last few years. But there's more of it all the time. And this fracking pipeline, Pacific Trail, is approved already. It is already approved, and they're, like, ready to pave the way for Enbridge, because it's the same route.
Right.
You know, they still have to clear the trees, they still have to dig a hole in the ground to lay the pipe, they have to go under or over the river, and so there's all this, so they're actually paving the way. And, you know, we've heard from our premier that, suddenly liquefied natural gas is going to save British Columbia. It's going to make us all rich. It's the one commodity that's not going to destroy the environment and so on, but it is very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gas drilling rigs explode and leak just the same as oil rigs do. And it's, from start to finish, it's almost as destructive as tar sands mining.
And the pollution in the water supply is unbelievable.
It's outrageous. You know, that they're actually puncturing through the water table, you know, with the, you know, and then mixing the water table with natural gas. You know, there are places in BC where you could turn on your tap and light it on fire.
Oh.
You know, you've probably seen that in the documentary. You know,
it's happening here.
Yeah, it's happening everywhere that they do this fracking.
So these folks have already tried to get into the Wet'suwet'en lands?
Yes, they have.
And they've been turned away?
Yes. So they're doing a blockade up there on the Morris River. So they have the bridge over the river is blocked. They will let people through if they're not there to do resource extraction. So the first, what I witnessed is there was a group that was coming. There's a team of workmen that was coming to try and clear the forest. They were going to cut the trees in the path of the pipeline, and they were turned away. So what we've been doing in solidarity here is people have been coming from all over North America, even other countries, to come and support the Wet'suwet'en people and their blockade. And we've organized this caravan for 2 years in a row. We bought a school bus, we filled it with food and supplies and people, and we brought that all up to the camp to supply the camp for the fall, to give volunteers to help build these. They're building more houses. They're building actual traditional homes.
Yeah, they're building traditional pit houses.
In the path of the pipeline.
That's amazing.
And they're building permaculture gardens. So it's permaculture, not pipelines. And we've been sending people up there for the past year and a half to assist with that. And, you know, I just don't think that we're going to stop this fracking and stop these pipelines just by negotiating with the government. I don't think there's any negotiating with the government. I don't think there's going to be any lobbying any of these corporations. They are just hell-bent on destroying the land and making any profits that they can, shipping our natural resources to China. So, you know, we really got to dig in here, and that's what we're doing.
So you think, like, writing letters to the editors is just not going to do it?
Well, people certainly should do that. They, if anybody who feels inspired and who's angry, and, you know, I really encourage people to be angry about what's happening to British Columbia. Because, you know, anger is something that happens when you realize that things that you love are being hurt, you know. So we should definitely write letters to the editor, but we should also get prepared to block these projects, to physically block them from happening. And that's what these people are doing. And here in Victoria, I know we're a long, long way from Prince George and Smithers, but we are preparing ourselves here. If there's a call out, if push comes to shove, and they send in the security people or whatever, if the police block the road, then we're standing by to respond. And we will go and go and stand on the line with the Indigenous people when they ask us to.
And you mentioned that they've already turned people away. So it's sort of like trying to cross a border. You get stopped and you're asked what your intentions are and how long you plan to stay and what you're going to be taking out of the place. And that seems perfectly reasonable to me. And so when these people are turned away, then they come back with other ways. Like you said, they helicoptered people in.
Yeah, when the last team came in by helicopter, and they had to find them and confront them there with the helicopter, and they said, "Oh, we had no idea that this was going on." And if that's true, that means that the higher ups do know that this is going on, and they're sending people in without informing them. They're just not respecting Indigenous territory, Indigenous sovereignty in this area. And again, there's no treaty. The courts have recognized that First Nations have underlying title. You know, they actually do have title to the land. And I believe otherwise Canada considers it to be Crown land. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, if they try to get an injunction, if they just try to keep forcing their way in and going around the blockade and so on, if they try to sue or prosecute people for defending their land. It's going to be very interesting, and, you know, we're waiting to see, very interested to see what happens, because they're there year-round, too. They're going to be occupying the land all winter, because otherwise the pipeline companies would be coming in, you know, by helicopter, by skidoo, and trying to, again, get around them.
So, thankfully, we have the internet and social media, so we can all keep an eye on these things. I know your website is wildcoast.ca, so
that's
you're
right.
Posting updates there. So, you know, how big of an area are we talking about? And maybe a little bit about what goes on when you go there. Like, I've seen photos of, you know, some people participating in workshops. I'm wondering what kind of workshops and what kind of things are you getting organized?
Mm-hmm. You know, it took us 2 days to get up there with the giant school bus because it's so slow. So, yeah, we spent several months collecting food and raising money to pay for the drive. And once we arrived, they have this free prior and informed consent protocol, and that's based on, well, it's traditional. And they said nobody ever trespassed on other people's land. They would ask, you know, or else it was an offense, right? So when we arrive at the bridge, people come in groups, and they're asked, like, it's like crossing a border. You know, who are you? Where are you from? What is your business here? Have you ever worked for the opposition, the resource companies that are threatening the land, and so on? And then people from Victoria helped set up the whole kitchen, you know, because there are hundreds of people, over 100 people at this, at any given time. You know,
cool.
People came and went. And the main work of the camp was there was decolonizing workshops. So for the people who are not native, who don't necessarily understand the ramifications of Indigenous territory, of genocide, where people have been forcibly removed from their territory, have been killed, have had their culture destroyed through residential schools and other deliberate, willful policies of the government. So it's asking people, settlers especially, to come to grips with the extreme brutality of Canada, you know, what Canada is founded on, which is, you know, stealing land and killing people, and making profit from that. So it's
and this is kind of like neo-colonialism. Like they're coming in and wanting to do it all over again.
It's the second wave. Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, they think that they subdued the natives, but no. You know, the native cultures, indigenous cultures are ascendant. They are coming back. They're coming to the fore. And, you know, I really see that, you know, white culture, European culture, colonial culture is it's reached the end, really, you know. How much further can they go? They're like, you know, using fresh water to break rock to get the last little bit of natural gas. If they're having to use steam to force the last little bit of tarry bitumen out of the ground, like, yeah, they must be crazy.
It is crazy. It's totally crazy. There was a news report on Al Jazeera yesterday about some field in England somewhere where they've already buried nuclear waste. And now, and it's on a fault line, and now they want to go fracking in there. Like, it's absolute insanity. And I thought to myself, like, why are they so resistant to, we know there's wind power, and we know there's solar power. Like, why are they so resistant to all of this, do you think?
Well, because you can't own a section of the wind.
Yeah.
You can't lease, capitalism. You can't lease the sun. Yeah,
it comes back to that profit motive, yeah.
So we did a lot of discussing, you know, exactly how dire things are,
mm-hmm.
exactly how much people are up against the wall, and, you know, what these companies are. And then, you know, the most important thing that we did at Unistoten Camp was to set up teams, to pledge to do the work, to fundraise to support the camp, to create these action teams, to do work in the communities around in Houston, Smithers, Prince George, you know, and to assist them any way possible. So, you know, we came back, we did a report back here, and it's been very, very positive. We have days of action coming up, and this is the next day of action is going to be. Well, there's days of action from August 14th. That's the day in solidarity with the Unistoten Camp, all the way to August 24th. So right now there's days of action going on, and people will be targeting companies like Chevron, for example, which is the owner of Pacific Trail Pipeline now, and Shell, and Royal Bank, and these companies that are largely responsible for these decisions to invest in fracking, invest in tar sands, and to disregard indigenous territory and try and force these projects through where they're definitely not wanted.
So there's a logic to going after the corporations rather than the government at this point?
We're doing both, obviously. People are doing both. The government won't negotiate. But the profit motive is a very powerful one, right?
Mm.
And so is uncertainty. And what they don't have is they don't have any certainty that if they do invest billions of dollars, these pipelines are very, very expensive,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have a whole lot of profit either. You have to spend billions of dollars, then you can make $1 billion. But if there's no guarantee that you're actually going to have a pipeline to the coast,
right.
at the end of all your expense, investors are not going to invest in that.
Mm-hmm.
So by creating uncertainty, we're raising the risk for the investors.
Right.
Because investors, it's not free money, right? If they put in $1 billion, they expect to get all of that back, plus interest,
right.
plus profit,
sure.
dividends, you know?
Yeah.
And without dividends, you know, they're certainly not going to go forward. And it's irresponsible for any, like, company that has shareholders to even consider, you know. What they're proposing here is like a 600-kilometer fracking pipeline. And they may have like 550 kilometers of that route secured, that they have agreements with the First Nations and so on. They've made promises to pay them off, right? That you're going to get...
They believe that again?
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's like, oh, this time for real. This time we're really going to make millions and millions of dollars, and we're going to share it with First Nations, not like all the other times when we just screwed people over. So they've secured a large section of the route, but they don't have the whole thing. And if you don't have if you don't have 600 kilometers of a 600-kilometer pipeline, you don't have a pipeline. If you have 590 kilometers,
right.
you don't have a pipeline. You have a very expensive waste of money. So this is where the uncertainty is strategic. And, you know, they've said, people have said that they would die. You know, they would lay down their lives. They would sacrifice everything to stop these pipelines coming through their land. And so they're behind schedule, too. This is the other good news. At this point, they're supposed to be almost a year in to building their pipeline for Pacific Trail. They haven't made a move other than sending these helicopter crews in. And it's very interesting because, like, they haven't filed suit. They haven't called in the RCMP.
There's some strategy there.
Probably.
Right?
They're probably going to make it illegal or something, you know, at the provincial level or something, or the federal level. But again, even if they do all that, if their investors have been scared away, they're still not going to be able to build a pipeline.
Well, I wonder about collaboration, because like you say, if they can clear the route, then they can put a whole whack of different pipelines through there. Like, they're probably all these folks. Are they collaborating? Are they getting investments from China where they want to ship
yes.
the natural gas?
Oh, certainly.
You know?
Yeah. This is our research project right now, and we were asked to please find out who the investment partners are, where the connections are to government. And so, this is our research project for this winter, is to expose those connections so we can go after them.
Right.
So we can target
and educate
them.
People. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, to divest and that sort of thing.
That's been working, too.
Has it?
Yeah. The Van City?
Yeah, that was a big victory.
Was that 2 years ago now?
It's a while ago, out of the Enbridge.
Yeah, they divested from Enbridge, and I think they could divest from the rest of the tar sands. They could divest from the fracking industry, the good natural
Are
gas.
Are they invested in that?
Probably. Mm,
yeah. Well, that's it. You get a portfolio, and you don't really know what's in it, I suppose. I'm wondering, what kind of response did you get in the local communities, like Prince George Smithers area? What are people thinking there?
Well, Indigenous people in those areas were very supportive. Just random people on the street. You know, you just have a little sign that says, you know, caravan to Wet'suwet'en, no pipelines, and people were shouting at us and waving at us and with the open hand, not with the finger or anything like that. We stayed in the community of Burns Lake. This is also a Wet'suwet'en community. And, everywhere we went, people were just, like, really positive, you know.
Settlers as well?
Settlers as well. You know, we had no hostility.
Great.
Yeah, I think, you know, they try hard to create this appearance that there's this consensus that pipelines are good and pipelines are safe. And we hear this...
Jobs
and safety and on the radio, on the television, all the time, in the newspapers. There is no consensus that pipelines are good or safe. Everybody knows that they're not.
Sure.
So don't be fooled.
Right.
You know, go out and talk to people. That's what we've been doing.
So can folks get ready for the next caravan then?
Yes, the next caravan will be coming next summer. And in the meantime, they are seeking volunteers at the camp. You know, so people who possibly have some skills in terms of camping, permaculture, construction, or even they're just able-bodied and willing to learn. You know, they and even if they're not able-bodied, but they have skills to contribute in terms of like building the website, assisting other folks in doing this construction and so on.
Kitchen
work, yeah, childcare, you know, anything like that. So there's an ongoing need, and people can contact us at wildcoast.ca. We will be preparing for another caravan. So far, you know what, it's working. So far, we're winning. You know, it may not look like it because nothing's happening, but that's why we're winning. That's how we know, because nothing's happening.
Right, right.
they're behind schedule. This is what we've seen in other campaigns that we did eventually win, is that you don't know what's going on. You know, just that nothing's happening. They're not going forward when they said they were going to. They don't make a big announcement saying, oh, the environmentalists beat us.
We're
going to go back to the boardroom and cry. You know, no, they don't do that. They don't never admit that they're being beaten.
They just go back and re-strategize.
Yeah, and you just don't hear
what
anything.
What can we do next?
Yeah. They probably are. That's probably what they're trying to do, is to re-strategize.
You can bet they are. So there's a fundraiser coming up.
On September 14th, Forest Action Network is hosting a big fundraiser on campus. CFUV is actually sponsoring it.
Yay.
And it's the Untamed Cabaret. This is happening at Felicitas Pub. So we're going to have burlesque and erotica with Rosie Bitts and friends. And a drag show with Tom Hatt. Live music with Compassion Gorilla and 99 Buck. And this is a benefit for Wildcoast.ca and Forest Action Network for our future caravans and our future work. So that's September 14th at Felicitas. And we actually have tickets on sale already at wildcoast.ca.
Well, thank you so much, Zoe.
Thanks, Janine. I'm happy to talk about this anytime. And, you know, people can call me. They can email me, zoe@wildcoast.ca. They can go on our website and our Facebook and our Twitter.
Right on, wildcoast.ca. Thanks again, Zoe.
Thank you.
Right, thanks to Zoe and Eric from Social Coast and all the good people who are supporting that camp and the people at the camp. They're very, very brave. Let's have a look at the weather. It looks like there's going to be some rain. And before we all go, you know, let's remember that this used to be a rainforest. And the reason that it's so beautiful here is because it rains. And, you know, we're really blessed to live in a part of the world that has clean, fresh water supply. And so there is going to be some rain according to the forecast. Speaking of watery things, I spent a little bit of time on August 8th outside the Irish Times pub on Government Street with Diane McNally, who is an elected school board trustee. And Diane is also an animal rights activist. And she was campaigning on that day, a very important day, for the watery whales. So I'm talking to Diane McNally, who's working to bring Lolita home. Who's Lolita, Diane?
Lolita is an orca from the Southern Resident Group of Orcas. They're fish eaters, and they mostly swim off the coast of Lower Vancouver Island. They sometimes head all the way down to around Oregon. She was taken in 1970 from Whidbey Island in the infamous Penn Cove Roundup, when many orcas from J, K, and L pods were taken into captivity. Many were killed, many unintentionally. Their stomachs were slit and filled with rocks so no one would discover the atrocity that had happened that day. A journalist pursued the report of orca bodies that had washed up eventually on the shoreline there, and that's when it all broke, how many orcas had been killed. So Lolita was taken, she's the only surviving orca from that group that was taken that day. So she has spent 43 years in the Miami Seaquarium in a tank that is not as deep as she is long, if you can imagine.
Wow.
And her family swims hundreds of miles every day. She can only swim 80 feet.
Wow.
So that's where she is. And the research is in on their mental abilities. Orcas have spindle cells that are highly evolved brain structures that deal with emotion, and we don't have the structures that orcas have. They have language, they have culture, they're highly family bonded. They should not be in captivity. If you have a chance, please see Blackfish. If it's playing near you, it will be out on DVD at some point. If you're here in Victoria, it will be at CineCentre September 29th and for that entire week.
So now you're working to bring Lolita home. Wouldn't that be a bit of a shock to just throw her back in the ocean?
Right. Many people have asked that, and it sure would. It sure would be a giant shock for her. After 43 years, because she's incredibly intelligent, we're believing that she can be retaught to catch her own fish in a sea pen. We would provide her with fish. She would be in a netted pen in Kanaka Bay, which is on Whidbey Island. We would not put her back in Penn Cove because the orcas will not come back to Penn Cove after that atrocity.
Really?
Yes, they've never been back.
Wow.
So we would put her in a sea pen, and interestingly, the orcas do not jump over nets. Nobody's figured that out. So we would have her in the sea pen, feed her for as long as it takes. Her teeth are still intact, unlike some orcas who have broken their teeth on the bars of various restraining cages, if you will, in other facilities. Miami's aquarium doesn't have bars for her to break her teeth on. So she could learn to recatch her fish. And because her family swims by there, we're hoping that because she hasn't forgotten her language, she was about 4 when she was taken, and she spent some time with her cousin in the same tank before he killed himself by ramming himself into the side of the tank. She has her language. And so as her family swims by talking to each other, because the southern residents are pretty chatty, we're hoping that they would communicate with each other and figure out a way to get back together. We have to play it by ear how that would go. And she may require care from us for the rest of her life, and we owe it. We've got the money. We've got the sea pen.
And you're working with people at Whidbey Island who are wanting to cooperate on this?
Yes, I'm working with Orca Network. Howard Garrett and Susan Berta there have been working on bringing Lolita home for decades. So, yes, I'm volunteering with them, and that's why I'm out here today, to bring her home after 43 years of imprisonment.
Seems like kind of the least we could do. So where can people get more information?
A good place to get more information, people can email me at freecaptiveorcas@gmail.com, or better still, go to the Orca Network website, orcanetwork.org. Another really interesting website is the Orca Project, which has focused on Tilikum in SeaWorld Orlando. Tilikum was once captive here in Victoria. That website also has a lot of information about Lolita and captivity in general.
All right. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
So I have a song from Maria Dunn, who was at the Vancouver Folk Festival. And I didn't get to hear a lot of her. I wish I had had more time to hear a lot more of everybody, but especially Maria. And so this is a song, We're Good People, and you're listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. This is The Winds of Change.
I was an ordinary mother in 1932. My husband out of work and more worries here than food. I was weary with asking the man for relief, feeling like a beggar, being treated like a thief. So when word of a protest started going round, I bundled my boys for the long walk downtown, and bless them, they didn't make a peep about the cold. One was only 5 and the other 9 years old. We were good people gathered in the square. It wasn't ease and comfort had driven us there. Well, the air was almost festive with Christmas trees in view. But as we turned to leave the square and march the avenue, a sound I'd never heard before turned my heart to lead. The sound of a billy club cracking open. Off the streets, it made me so angry. They'd endanger children too in silencing the voices of 1932. We were good people gathered in the square. It wasn't but they treated us like criminals for showing our despair. Oh, I remember well this bloody Tuesday. Government scraping by for our daily bread. We had voted for the cowards, and the way they turned their heads. Now I've read it in the paper, this supposed hunger march was a scheme of Reds, they said. Our hunger was a farce. I don't care what they say, for me it did ring true. An ordinary mother in 1932. We were good people gathered in the square. It wasn't ease and comfort had driven us there, but they treated us like criminals for showing our despair. Remember well this bloody Tuesday. I remember well this bloody Tuesday.
That was Maria Dunn's We Were Good People off her album We Were Good People, which explores the stories of working people in Western Canada. Tales of resilience and hope through experiences of immigration, internment, exploitation, and the Depression. Up next is a few minutes with Chrissy Brett, who represents the Indigenous and Settler Allies Homemakers Association. You're listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM. These are the Winds of Change. Hi, Chrissy. My name's Janine. I publish the street news and I have a radio show at CFUV.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, I don't know what your plan is. I don't want to interrupt, but I'd like to have, if you want to talk.
Sure.
Are you the organizer here today?
It was an association organization. I started a hunger strike similar to Chief Spence's that turned into more of a cultural fast back in February. And I've worked with MCFD off and on as an advocate for years.
Okay, so, and you were on a hunger strike because?
I'm just tired of not only MCFD breaking their promises, but First Nations leaders breaking their promises. Back in 2002, the First Nations leaders from the Assembly of First Nations, the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, and Assembly of First Nations, the BC Association of Friendship Centers, and the United Native Nations came together with on-reserve chiefs and agreed to work together to move Aboriginal child welfare forward and look at more fair funding formulas. And we did about five years of work to create regional Aboriginal authorities similar to the health authorities that would give Aboriginal people direct decision-making abilities around the services or service money that should be going to Aboriginal services. At the time, there was just less than 1% of the service delivery dollars going to Aboriginal services, yet there was 40% of the kids in care were Aboriginal. Now there's 55% of the kids in care that are Aboriginal, and yet we still have about the same percentage of service delivery dollars going into Aboriginal services. So that needs to change. In 2008, the Assembly of First Nations, Union of BC Indian Chiefs, and First Nations Summit withdrew their support with, I believe, 158 of the chiefs withdrew their support, saying that they wanted more consultation around how the money was split up and that they wanted a bigger say than, say, some of the urban population, yet half of the Aboriginal population are urban Aboriginal people. So when they withdrew their support, all of the work crumbled, and we're still no farther ahead than we were back then. So I just see that the chiefs are talking, but they aren't actually doing anything, and our kids are still in crisis, and they're still in trouble.
So what are you ultimately you're hoping for?
We're hoping that our Aboriginal leaders will actually come back to the table and work towards actual fair funding formulas and services for Aboriginal children and families that work, rather than just doing the status quo of looking for more consultation. We want action. We want services that will actually support families in staying together. If you look at cultural law, usually if there's a problem in the family, it's the problem that's removed, not the children. And we're saying that MCFD should be taking stronger steps to creating the structure around the children and putting in whatever supports are necessary for supporting a family. And we're not saying that there aren't families that do need support services to be the parents that they deserve, but when you look at the cost of taking a child and apprehending and putting them into foster care is like a huge amount of money. Whereas if you kept a family of, say, 5 kids at home and put in family development workers that work 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, it would still only be a $25,000 cost for that person's services over the year rather than $40,000 per kid.
So why don't they just do that, do you think?
I think that the wheels of justice move slowly. I think that the people up top make sometimes the best decisions with the tools that they've got. I think that if they actually sat down and worked with people that have worked through their issues and through the system, that there would be a lot more positive types of support services that families would actually embrace rather than step back from. And if they recognize things like residential school legacies or authority issues of people that have chronically grown up in poverty and foster care, have those like authority issue barriers. So if you start recognizing them and working in a more holistic way, in a community-centered based way, then the very like way that they do sort of asking questions and you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent, and at least in a criminal court of law, you're innocent until you're proven guilty, and it's mostly up to the parents to prove that they're not guilty of whatever. Sometimes they're false and malicious complaints, and it can take a year or 2 years to clear up. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, the pressure of having the ministry focusing on your life, I mean, are a stress factor. Mm-hmm. So rather than supporting a family, they just come in with more intrusive measures. And that's not what their policy is about. Their policy is about trying to embrace what's best for the child. So we're just saying that they need to relook at a lot of their services, a lot of the way they work with people, a lot of the ways that they tell people that they aren't allowed to bring in advocates that would make them more comfortable in working with social workers, and then they're being labeled as difficult. And I mean, when clearly they just would like somebody there for emotional support, and it changes the dynamics of things. So.
Absolutely. And so this organization then that sprang out of your hunger strike, what's it called?
The Indigenous and Settler Allies Homemakers Association. It's sort of modeled after the Indian Homemakers Association. And so there was a group of us when I was doing the hunger strike. Donna was one of the other elders that had started a similar fast, and she went for 7 weeks with me, and I did a full 4 months. So we both did like a liquid diet for 4 months.
And I'm so sorry I didn't hear about it.
Yeah, so we were down at the Parliament buildings, and Donna joined me, and then Jocelyn Samick joined me, and Thea Twitter Hanks have come together. And it was funny, all of us had a link to the late Lex Reynolds, and he was a family lawyer that was a champion for Aboriginal children and families. He was with the fellow that represented Harvey Charlie in the coroner's inquest of Sherry Charlie's death.
Right.
And all of us had linkages back to Lex in him helping to keep our families together. So it was kind of neat that all of us who had never known each other before all came together, and we decided that maybe it wasn't actually making the ministry come to a meeting and talking to us. Maybe it was us needing to go out and do things on our own to change the system.
So do you have any allies, like Mary Ellen Turville-Lamond, I understand her office has just produced a new report talking about the conditions that kids are in?
Absolutely. We've had discussions with her office. We've also had discussions with the minister's office around a lot of our concerns, and some of them are doable. Some of them, they've said, it's going to take like a lifetime to make those changes. But I mean, there's a start, and that's where we figure we're doing holistic family court support work, whether it's Family Relations Act or whether it be Child and Family Community Service Act. We believe that we should be supporting families in a holistic way through like their physical, their mental, their emotional, and the whole nine yards. So.
Right on. Is there a website that people can go to?
We're on Facebook, so if they go into the Indigenous and Settler Allies Homemakers page, he right can on. Like it and see what we're doing.
Okay, thanks for your work, Chrissy.
Thank you.
All right. So I just want to thank everybody. Zoe, thanks again for taking the time, and Chrissy Brett, and all the people here at the station who take care of everything behind the scenes. Of course, you're going to stay tuned now for Democracy Now! And all the good programming. I'm going to leave you with some music from Jason Bernstick, who's from Manitoba, an Indigenous man. Also, someone I heard at the Vancouver Folk Festival. And thanks again for listening, and have a great couple of weeks, everybody. And please do look out for each other.
All I want is a home tonight.
All I want is a home tonight.
the show. I've still got a few extra minutes. I'm editing this. This is a pre-recorded show, and I would do this much more professionally and you know, insert another piece of music somewhere in the, but honestly, I've spent several hours doing this, and I kind of have other things I need to get done. So, this is why I like live radio. You know, you bring people in the studio, you talk to them, it's over. Not that I don't love radio, it's just, you know, the time. So anyways, I'll just make a quick announcement about a powwow that's happening in Duncan, this weekend. Let me just find that information. It is, sounds like a great event. It's going to be a cultural experience with dancing and drumming and lots of interesting things to experience. It's happening at the CM Lelum Gym at Duncan, 5574 River Road. I'm going to leave you with a song that Charity Hume sent me now. Charity, you may recall, is formerly a host at CFUV, and she sent this beautiful piece of music from a friend of her son's, who's Abby Berry. She's 15 years old, and she's singing Skylark.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Might you tell me where my love can be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, spring, where my heart can go a journey beyond the shadows and the rain to a blossom-covered lane, and in your lonely flight, haven't you heard the music in the night? Wonderful music, faint as a will-o'-the-wisp, crazy as a loon, sad as a gypsy serenading the moon. Oh, skylark, I don't know if you can find these things, but my heart riding on your wings. So if you see them anywhere, won't you leave?